Cresta join me and my guests as we try to develop conversations of consequence. It's talk radio where God matters, looking at all life through the lens of the Scripture and the teaching of Christ Church.
Cresta in the Afternoon, weekdays from 4 to 6 on 990 WDEO.
Radio for Catholic and other Christians. This is 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the Internet at WDEO.net.
My guest in this hour is Marjorie Dannenfelser. Marjorie is a president and an original founder of the Susan B. Anthony List in Washington, D.C. The SBA is a national pro-life group dedicated to pursuing policies of supporting life and other important issues such as marriage and religious liberty. But they're a very political organization. SBA List brought to the pro-life movement a political arm that it never had before. That is, it gets on the ground and acts politically to elect pro-life members of Congress and, in many cases, to unelect members of Congress. Marjorie has become, if not the most important pro-life leader in the country, at least one of the handful. Marjorie, welcome to Church and Culture. I believe you've been on one time before.
Oh, it's one of my favorite places to be. Thank you for inviting me again, Dale.
Thank you, Marjorie. And Marjorie, by the way, my listener is a very good friend of mine, so if you notice us seeming chummy, it's because we are.
Amen, and our families.
We want to talk about several different things. We want to talk about the success of SBA in the last election, the 2014 election, which was really historic. But before we get to that, let's talk about the Pain Capable Act, which, for example, Maggie Gallagher insists on calling the five-month bill, which means that abortion would be outlawed after 5 months, except in the case of rape and incest. This was a bill that was passed by the House by a wide margin in 2013. A variety of women members of Congress were on the floor speaking very, very courageously about their support for it. When it was put back onto the House agenda to be voted for on March for Life Day about a month ago, it was suddenly withdrawn the very evening before the march. I know this was a big disappointment to you. Why was it withdrawn?
First, let me say why this is so important, and then it'll give a little bit of flavor as to the consequence of being withdrawn and why we got to get it back on track and head it towards the Senate. The importance of this bill that has already been passed in now 14 states. West Virginia just passed it out of two democratically controlled legislatures. The Democratic governor vetoed it, and then his veto was overridden. What a beautiful display of
bravo, politics, bravo.
What that can mean. Amen. It's moving ahead in Ohio. It's moving ahead in South Carolina. It's a hot bill. Okay, so 14 states right now. It's important because not just because it's moving. It's moving because of its focus. Its focus is on the unborn child for truly, honestly, the first time, except for the partial birth abortion ban, on the child itself. What happens and what's happening with that child at that stage, what's different about the partial birth abortion ban and this particular bill is that it chooses a time where we say, after this point, no more. This child is of our community. We will protect them by the law and welcome them into the world. That is a bill. This is a line that has been drawn by almost every nation in the world, except for seven nations. And we are among those seven, and we are among countries like China and North Korea and Vietnam and Singapore and Canada and the Netherlands. Now, especially those top few, you don't want to be in that human rights club. That's not a club you want to call what we call our own nation, which is the shining city on the hill for human rights. So that this bill is so important because of that, because it focuses on the child, because it has tremendous consensus across demographic lines generally, gender, politics, party, age group. It is a incredibly popular bill. That's why it has this momentum. That's why all of the women that we helped elect last cycle brought this to the floor in a beautiful display of feminine unity in communicating this, why this bill was so important. Passed with ease. Why we got to work in the Senate elections. We helped bring 9 new pro-life senators to the U.S. Senate in a really hard-fought battle on the ground going door-to-door. And so the Senate is set up to do this. So why did this happen? Something happened in the House among the women that were there. They were very concerned that there were about the reporting requirement for the rape exception. Okay, so let's just put one thing out there, Deal. Do we think there's, you know, the idea that there's a rape exception at all is crazy. You know, at six, almost.
Life is life.
Even if it was at 1 month, it would still be objectionable. But at that point, it clearly should not be there. The reporting requirement was just that it be reported to local authorities. Well, so I think this is a great example of political and spiritual confusion. I really think that's true. This same exact bill passed exactly as is last session, with all this great unity. And then as it moved into this next time where it was going to be voted upon, there was just a storm of disunity and inability to communicate among the women there. And that is the true story that I've probably never said on any outlet anywhere. That is the true story of what happened. There was no clandestine, outside, nefarious pro-abortion organization that killed this. Our own friends stalled it. Now, what's going to happen now is that it will get back on the floor. God is my witness, Scarlett and I will be on the floor.
You sound like Davy Crockett at the Alamo.
and Tara, both. So, but it will happen. It will get to the floor. We are working constantly just to get the language right. There's been a unbelievable backlash from the pro-life movement, which the Congress deserves for not getting this right. After that, it'll move to the Senate quickly, and then we pray that it will pass there quickly. It hasn't passed the Senate yet. We know that we have over 50 votes. But of course, we have a president that is not inclined to sign. And so that's why the ultimate part of this current strategy is to truly press in on the potential presidential candidates who will be the ones to sign this bill. So that's been kind of the last 2 months of strategy at Susan B. Anthony List, and something you've been right in the middle of, Deal, so I know you have your
own. Well, Scarlett, Marjorie, you actually at SBA have been asking the presidential candidates to write letters of support for this bill. Have you got everybody responding to your request?
Well, we have everybody but one, and we asked for this commitment almost a year ago, and it's a very simple request. It is, please write to us in your own words about why you think this bill should be a top priority and why you will commit to advance it when you are, and then sign it as the president. So everybody send theirs in is a pretty easy call for most people. Scott Walker dragged his heels a little bit. He just sent that in last week, which is great news. The one holdout right now is Chris Christie. We have not heard from Chris Christie. It is not for lack of trying. And I believe that he is pro-life, but we're still, what is pro-life often gets to be the question. If you don't want a guy in the Oval Office who forgets who they are, and so a piece of paper that expresses their convictions is a great thing to bring to a meeting once they become a president. So we're waiting for that from him.
I'm talking with Marjorie Dannenfeldtzer, longtime president of the SBA list and pro-life leader. I wonder, Marjorie, if the listeners realize that this bill, this pain-capable act, is the most significant piece of pro-life legislation since Roe versus Wade. Do you think that people understand that?
I don't think so. I don't think so. And I would say on one hand, it seems so modest. and it is so modest. It's such a modest proposal to say after that place where you're encouraged to sing to your child, where they move, they can actually understand rhythm, you know, all the things we know, that you protect them at that point. And I think the truth of the matter is that most Americans have not realized until fairly recently, because of the misinformation in the media mainly and in the political world, that it was even legal, that it was legal at all. The misinformation about Roe versus Wade has always been that it's only legal in the first trimester.
That's right. You hear that. You still hear that all the time.
You still hear it, and it's just simply not true. It's a complete, because you can go to D.C. today and get an abortion up until right before birth.
And that's why we had the passage of the partial birth abortion ban in, 2002 or 3, right? Because babies were getting aborted as they were coming out of the womb.
That's right. That's right. That's why the Gosnell horror in Pennsylvania, we saw children at 22, 23, 24, and beyond weeks, even though in the state of Pennsylvania it was supposedly illegal after a certain stage, after 24 weeks. You're seeing that, we were seeing that happen. And, you know, these children were being aborted at the stage where, in the words of Gosnell, this horrible abortionist, that he bragged that he could have walked this kid to the bus stop. He was so proud of his ability to kill the child at that point. So these children, ready for the world, willed by God, intended for a purpose, killed not long before birth, deserve to be protected. And they haven't been since 1973. I consider this phase three of the pro-life movement. Phase one was the shock and awe of the incredible injustice of wiping out every single pro-life protection in the nation because of the falsehood of Roe and his companion Doe decision. And an inability, sadly, because whatever the reason, not to be able to kind of get ahead of that and pass something on the federal level that would protect children at some stage, at least test the mettle of the Supreme Court that most people say didn't intend the consequence that it had. Phase two was, so there was that sad failure and inability to get ahead of the problem. In phase two, we legislated around the issue for a couple of decades, meaning parental notification before you get it, informed consent before you get it, making sure, and thank God that sonograms were looked at, that they were actually obtainable, that you would, and that there are now sonograms in pregnancy care centers, so everybody knows what we're talking about when we talk about it. Legislating around it. Now we're in phase three, in my view, and that is beyond partial birth abortion, because that was just a procedure. That's still legislating around the substance of the problem. The problem of killing the unborn child before its birth at any stage is now being addressed by drawing a line at almost 6 months. And it's modest, but it is politically smart, and it is obviously the right moral thing to do. And we really believe that injected in the middle of this next presidential cycle, it will be defining. And it's a chance for our candidates to go on the offense again after this last election cycle and win for the children and their mothers.
Marjorie, isn't it the case that the number of abortions or the percentage of abortions done after 5 or 6 months is fairly small, and that the practical outcome of this pain-capable act would be to eliminate perhaps 80% of abortions?
Well, it's all in your perspective. I mean, after 20 weeks, after 5.5 months or so, there are about 15 to 18,000 children that are aborted, according to our research arm, the Charlotte Lozier Institute. 15 to 18,000 children is a
each year. Is that year
group.
Per year?
Each year, and that's a size. That's a small town of people. And I think regularly, what would you do for the one? You know, I'm sitting here in D.C., not far from the railroad tracks at Union Station. If I thought that there was a child standing on the tracks there right now, I would hang up right now, and I would get myself over there, and I would pull them off the tracks. But for 18,000, I get up every day excited to get into this battle again and make sure that any, you know, weak-kneed politician who doesn't know what it means to fight for unborn children knows. Because it's about the one. If you don't get the one, you can't get the two or the 15,000 or the 18,000 or the 4,000 per day. You know, that's why this is a beginning, truly, in this phase three, whatever we want to call it. It's a beginning of bringing these children into the human family.
Well, you know, the 2014 election was also a kind of beginning. Not entirely so, because you had great success in 2010 and some other successes in between. But in 2014, Susan B. Anthony List had an unprecedented pro-life political operation, which paid off. I mean, we have more pro-life members of Congress than I think ever before. And
true.
Tell our listeners just, you know, what you put out there that reaped such a great amount of fruit.
Well, the great news is that the community effort that this really is involved people in huge operations in several states, North Carolina, Arkansas, Louisiana, and Kansas, where the people of those states who believe like you and I do, agree with us that we had to return to the human center of politics and the movement. I mean, this is about understanding what human beings are, and also in terms of life, in terms of those kids, but then also what politics is. Politics is at its best, human being to human being, neighbor going to knock on the door of a neighbor and say, do you know what's at stake in this? Did you know these things? And so in the end, all told, at the end of the election, we were able to pull out several close elections, North Carolina being the closest. But let me just say this. They weren't as close in the end as they were in the beginning. And so part of this whole process is to make sure that you are so strong that a race that looked really tight turns out to break your way. And that's exactly what happened in almost all all of these states. North Carolina remained close. But we knocked on over 500,000 doors in those four states. We had 700 pro-life activists knocking on doors.
On the ground. Day.
On the ground. I mean, person to person.
That's a huge operation.
We're talking to people who are already pro-life. We weren't trying to convince somebody who's not registered to vote and is pro-choice to vote for us.
You were making sure that all of these pro-life voters got to the polls.
Yes. Yes, and who normally in a midterm election are not. That's who we're targeting. We're targeting those voters who are normally not voting in midterm elections.
That's a very important point. There's usually a steep drop in the number of voters in a midterm congressional election. And especially those who aren't engaged by whatever the issue du jour was. You made the life issue one of the most important issues in the election.
Well, with God's help and these wonderful people on the ground and a lot of money, frankly, you know, some of the cheaper things are what we do in the pro-life movement. Our labor is cheap in terms of money, high cost in terms of our commitment. But you know, we spent this cycle $15 million and began very early in all those states to make that happen. And we have left those states just for a bit, and I believe that we have left them better states for it. The people there, the organizations there, are excited and ready to keep moving forward. And I will tell you also, and I know you've seen this deal, the members of the senators themselves get it. And that really matters. It really matters that they are saying, I thank the pro-life movement for my win. And it does not generally happen that way.
Well, I was there when Senator Ernst personally thanked you and the SBA list for your help.
Well, you know, they know. They can't miss it. And when you have somebody like Joni Ernst who's pro-life herself, my feeling has always been, my conviction, that if she's going to step out there and be that advocate, we have got to be the wind in her sails. It's our obligation to be the wind in her sails. And the same is true for the other senators that were elected. That sometimes it's hard. Pro-life issue is not tri-supports for dairy farmers. It's hard. I mean, that may be hard in some way. This is hard when you go home. you just need people behind you who say, this is a person of integrity, and we believe in her or him, and we're going to fight until she wins. And they know that, and they should be able to always count on that. For all the cynicism that there is, and most of it is earned, about what's going on in D.C., the bright moments are those moments on the floor when our leaders that we've helped elect are our advocates on this. And, when I was doing this 20 years ago, we're on the Hill, the big complaint was that no one was helping elect and no one was supporting them when they did the right thing. And they said, it's supposed to be enough that we're doing the right thing. Yes, we get that. But we need the support and the help.
SBA List has evolved into just that, the only grassroots political arm of the pro-life movement. I want to make it clear to our listeners, Marjorie, that the $15 million that you spent in the 2014 election, that did not go into your bank account. That went out for direct mail, that went out for radio, that went out for television, billboards, that went out to support the people on the ground, phone calls.
Go door to door. Right. The emphasis exactly was, of all that money, the biggest clump of that was the human being talking to a human being, either at your door or on the telephone. The door is far better. It takes a lot to get out of your house and go talk to somebody in your town about why this is, so it's recognized. And we've got such beautiful reports back. It's kind of, it is really about the change in people as they were at the door. And for people,
tell us a story. I mean, that's wonderful. Do you have a particular story in mind?
Yeah, we have from every state, but there's a particular one in Louisiana that really touched me. That we had a big operation there. It was tough because in the very beginning, Mary Landrieu was way ahead. Nobody believed that we could beat her. Nobody believed, and because she was so good at hiding her pro-abortion convictions, and in Louisiana, you have to. So we had a huge operation there with many partners on the ground. And here's just one story that came back to me just in an email, and it came from somebody who was on the other side of the door who just answered the door when somebody knocked. She says, a few minutes ago, I was greeted by a very kind woman representing your committee at my front door, and I must admit that I wasn't planning to vote and very distrustful of politicians, as well as how issues like abortion can become politicized. In this meeting, I expressed this very respectfully, and she was very understanding of my position. She conducted a brief poll and made a request of me if I voted. However, after the young lady left, something changed in my thoughts and in my actions. I'm compelled to write to you and let you know that I'll be voting on Tuesday and will vote for Bill Cassidy.
Wow.
Regardless of Mr. Cassidy, my views on him or my views on the entire political process, my vote would mean something to this woman who has given her time on this Saturday. There was a spirit in this woman that I identified with. Strangely enough, I could see God.
Wow.
Or an angel. We didn't speak once of religion or spiritual beliefs, yet it was something I could just see. And I hope this email finds its way to her. Please give her my thanks.
I bet you cried when you read that, knowing you.
I did.
Talking with
you know I did.
My friend and a nationally known and effective pro-life leader, Marjorie Danfeltzer, the president of the SBA list. I'm really, though, intrigued. We have a few minutes left in this part of the interview, but I'm intrigued by your comment that in these four states that where you really blanketed the area, that you left networks that I assume you can tap into again in 2016. Is that right?
Yes, that's true. And the North Carolina's operation is still up and running. We know that that's going to be volatile, potentially purple. So that operation with Tammy Fitzgerald, a great North Carolinian, is our woman in North Carolina. All the other networks and all the other places we've been, our goal is this. In the pro-life movement, it is very difficult to, very often there's a insularity, there's an inability to trust, born of many years of frustration. Our goal is to go in and truly be the wind in the sails of the people that are there, not to start an independent group or compete, but to really help make good things happen there and leave it better than when we left, than when we got there, excuse me. And I really believe that that's true, and we, of course, keep those networks going, and we will continue to do that. We will put our money in the future in places where we must win, like Ohio and Florida, and for the presidency, these key places that must be won. And we work all the time for that trust. I mean, it really is hopefully Christ-like, built on a foundation of trust that what we want is to save the babies and the mothers. That is,
well,
and then we'll close down shop.
It's clear you're receiving a blessing in your work. I'm talking with Marjorie Danfeltzer, president of the Susan B. Anthony List in Washington, D.C. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back with Marjorie in just a moment.
This program is made possible in part by CatholicBusinessPages.com, dedicated to helping grow businesses for a strong community of faith and Christian values. CatholicBusinessPages.com is your online directory resource for connecting you with businesses that have taken a strong stand to support those values that impact our lives. If Christian principles make a difference in your life, then CatholicBusinessPages.com will link you to business professionals who care about the values of our nation. CatholicBusinessPages.com, a great place to get connected.
Light of the East, weekends on Ave Maria Radio.
I'm Father Thomas Loya. This week on Ave Maria, people often look for that one book where they can learn more about the Eastern churches. While this requires more than just one book, there is one particular place that does have much to offer.
Saturday evenings at 8:30 and Sunday mornings at 9 on 990 WDEO, Ave Maria Radio.
Hi, this is Father John Ricardo, inviting you to join me as we explore some of the deepest questions that arise in our hearts, questions that shape the way we think, the way we speak, and the way we live. For all of these questions, Christ is the answer.
Our individual and corporate relationship with our Lord, our relationship with the church, the precepts of the church, our relationship with the world and the culture that surrounds us. Father John Ricardo discusses these things and more, all from the Catholic perspective on Christ is the answer. Listen to Christ is the Answer Wednesday evenings at 8, Saturday afternoons at 5, and Sunday mornings at 11 on 990 WDEO, 1440 WMAX, and AveMariaRadio.net on the Internet.
Christ is the way, the truth, and the life. He is the image of the invisible God. He points us to our destiny. He reveals the dignity of the human person. He is the one who makes known the Father. Christ is the Answer.
Christ is the Answer is brought to you by the Ave Maria Communications Guild.
I'm back with Marjorie Danfeltzer, president of the Susan B. Anthony List in Washington, D.C. Susan B. Anthony List is the only truly political arm of the pro-life movement, meaning
They put people on the ground. They send people door to door. They put people on the phones to make sure that pro-lifers get out to vote. And then when members of Congress don't do the right thing, they get involved in that as well. And Marjorie, that's what I want to ask you about. You had a moment in your career, in your really apostolate, back in 2009, when you were deeply disappointed by Congressman Bart Stupak and another 19 Democratic members of Congress who had said publicly over and over that they were going to oppose Obamacare because of its abortion funding. And then you learned suddenly that they had changed their vote under pressure from the White House. That kind of fundamentally changed your attitude, didn't, toward being in politics, not just to elect, but also to unelect?
It is. You described a really tough moment there, and it did change my views. When we started, which was, when I say we, really small number of we, in my house, it was about $5,000 a year with a group of women, we didn't have the ability to unelect anybody, but we did have the ability to help some people, and so that was a good and important and modest start, and according to the principle of being at the center of elections that lead to legislation. But once we got a little bigger and we were at the center of the legislative battle over health care and whether abortion would be included in health care, which of course is an oxymoron to say abortion and health care in the same sentence, but our allies, who I had always worked with from the time I was on the Hill working for a pro-life Democrat, were with us completely. Our pro-life Democrats were solid, they seemed. And Bart Stupak was truly, in my eyes at that point, a hero. And in my meeting with him and reassuring him that we would be there for him no matter what, I just, you know, it's such an exciting thing to know that no matter how hard the pressure gets, that he wouldn't cave, which were his exact words of Bart Stupak. And then, of course, the whole other group of pro-life Democrats were of the same mind. When they were told that an executive order would fix the problem wrongly, in our view, and as
well, it's a complete hoax.
View of the Republican Party. It was a complete hoax. It was a cover. But, you know, there were people waiting to be convinced. I don't never know exactly what's going on in the minds and hearts of these guys, but what happened was they caved. They did not hold out for his own bill. Bart Stupak didn't hold out for his own bill, which would have amended the legislation.
That was his amendment with Pitts.
That's right. That's
yes.
Right. Great guy from Pennsylvania. He caved. He changed his mind. And he changed his mind, but we were still in the same place that we always were, and we're in the same place now, because as it's turned out, without a statutory fix to that problem, there was no change, and abortion funding is finding its way into the world. So our decision, what you must do if you take yourself seriously as an election-oriented organization, which we do, is that you must unelect. You must defeat anyone who has done such a centrally anti-life thing. Otherwise, the NRA is stronger than the Right to Life movement. Otherwise, yeah, every other issue where people take themselves seriously is more powerful than the pro-life issue. And the only group that's out there not being not being the disciplinarian of the pro-life movement has more power. And not only that, it's just the right thing to do. So we did seek, and we prevailed in 15 out of 20 elections, with not a lot of glee in my heart, but certainly a conviction that these guys needed to be unelected. And Stupak and Driehaus and my old boss, Alan Mollahan, were numbered in those.
So you actually helped defeat the Democrat who had been your boss and mentor when you first worked on the Hill, correct?
Yes. Yes, a mentor in many ways, and somebody who attracted me to the Hill because I knew how important being a pro-life Democrat and being able to make that work was. he taught me something really important. And he's a West Virginia smart guy, politically smart as well. And he said, if you're going to shoot a bear, you better kill it.
And well, that's exactly what you ended up doing, didn't you?
Yeah. So on the day of that vote, on the day of the moment where they all changed their minds and they all caved, they all voted for the bill, that's the first thing that came back to me, is that we're going to go after them, but we're going to go after them and we're going to win. And they may have vocations in the world. We know that they do. Everybody's called to something. But right now, they have shown that they are not worthy of this one. They need to go do something else.
You were on this. I think you were on the steps of the Rayburn Building on the Hill when you got the news.
Right.
And then you got a call from a major media outlet. I'm not sure if it was the Wall Street Journal or Politico.
Yes.
And you found yourself saying what at that moment?
I said, these guys are going to be defeated. If, again, another God is my witness moment.
Now, this is not the Marjorie Dannenfeldt
guys
that ran the SBA list prior to that. Am I correct in saying that?
No, that's true. I think I thought that you could just be a really, really close, great friend. And that would be power enough to help people do the right thing. I really thought that was true. And I was never a person who really loved conflict. I mean, I'm from the South, and I don't really love conflict. I mean, I know at least my model of being from the South. I liked harmony, just like everybody does. But I learned in these moments that if you have a mission, you have a call, and something very difficult like this, that it's far better to be feared than to be loved. To be loved would have been by these guys, would have been to stick with them, but the mission would be lost. And what would you have? You have a friendship that is passing, and we're all in heaven one day. What would you say? Like, those guys liked me? I mean, it just became so clear, so obvious in that moment that the right thing to do would be to defeat those guys. And so this, you're right, this Wall Street Journal reporter called me just when I happened to be standing on the steps of the Rayburn Building right after there was a press conference with Obama announcing this executive order, and it was just so crystal clear. There are some moments that are clear, and that was it. That's the defeating, okay? The electing is way more fun, but the problem is after you elect, as everybody knows, the job has just begun. The job of helping that leader be who they are called to be has only
helping or policing.
Yeah, both. A true friendship. What is Aristotle's idea of true friendship?
Well, I mean, give our listeners an idea without naming names of the kind of thing that can happen after you have worked so hard and put so much effort and your resources into getting someone elected. Because they're pro-life, what kind of things can happen and do happen?
What happens is that the candidate who's been elected knows very, very well that you're an important part. And this doesn't happen in every single race, but in the most important races, this is what happens often. They know that your part in their election was really important, and you share that pro-life conviction. And at that point, it's easy. It's like being a newlywed. Yay, hooray, we are pro-life. We are going to do the great thing. And there's mutual praise and love. And then when they come into their own as a legislator, and they're fighting this easy-to-underestimate pressure within the halls of Congress, among leadership, among consultants, their staff, pressures coming from every which way, then that clarity starts to get muddy. And so decisions that they thought they were, you know, they thought were really obvious and clear, well, you know, life is way more complicated than you might have realized, Marjorie. And like, no, I actually realized it was going to be hard the entire time. And that is the kind of conversation that I've had more than once. And on the Senate and the House side, that's why you can't leave them. They need to hear. You remember that person? I've said this to more than one person. I feel like such a mommy. I've already got kids, so it gets a little hard sometimes. Do you remember that person who was a missionary for life, that person who would rather lose than falter on the pro-life issue, even in just a small prudential judgment moment? You remember that person? I want to see them right now. I want to know you again. That's the kind of conversation that you have if you're actually a friend.
Now, you once told me a story about Henry Hyde addressing a group of newly elected members of Congress that is important to you and I think very powerful for our listeners to hear.
Yeah, it was, he was really just truly my hero. And he gave a beautiful speech to the freshman class. He was quite a statesman. And his speech to the freshman class, all the newly elected House members, had many parts, but the part that was most memorable was, it's important for you to pick the issue that you are willing to stake everything on, that you're going to go to the mat on, that you're willing to lose over. You got to figure out what that thing is. What is that thing? And he was a man who chose the pro-life issue. And he did many things, but that was the one for him. And that is those are the words of a statesman. Those are a Churchill. Those are a Henry Hyde, in my view. And there are examples throughout history of Witherspoon, and then, you know, we know all those guys. And it just means know who you are, what are you called to do. It's vocation. It's keep asking. Keep, you know, and what our view is that if you don't understand your call that you said before the election, you said your call before the election was to be pro-life, and then you falter in the meantime, well, you're not worthy of this office anymore, because that's not what the founders had in mind. They loved intellectual engagement. They loved the great argument. They loved things that they deprived themselves of. Because they had to engage in just pure fighting in politics and in war. They didn't do what was comfortable, and they also knew they picked the thing that they were willing to give everything up for, and that was the founding of the nation. I would submit that the saving of one life is perhaps more important than founding of an entire nation.
Well, I think most of our listeners would agree with you. I'm wondering, though, you know, we hear all the time the buzz, especially in the mainstream media, that being pro-life, having traditional values, is a turnoff and a negative, a burden for a candidate. Isn't it the case that the evidence shows exactly the opposite?
I think we're going to hear less and less of that, because I think you're right that the recent evidence is better. I think that perhaps that was true, and it will still be true, and certainly in some cases. But I think one thing, we worked very hard at this. One thing is true, is that candidates who are going into elections now, their consultants might not know this. Their campaign managers might not know this, but they know they are going to be the ones that have to talk about their pro-life position. And I talk with them one-on-one about that, asking the tough questions, what do you think? And I think if you haven't dug deep, if you haven't sat down and really thought deeply and said in succinct sentences what you believe to be true, you must do it now.
You actually help candidates learn how to do that, right?
Yeah, it's the two wings of a dove. You help them speak for themselves, and then you speak for them in the grassroots. And that it must be that way. It can't just be that we're taught saying beautiful things about them. He or she has to show themselves to be somebody of integrity and what being for life really means. So it matters. I mean, we have manuals, we have training videos, but I have found the best training is just direct conversation, the murder board style, hard questions. You know, are you really for these things? Are you really for putting women in jail? You know, all the tough questions. And then on the flip side, I'm going to be the other candidate, and how will you put me on defense? I just want to hear you do that. and not giving them any tips. And so it just, and then of course it moves on from there. But, you know, the crazy counterintuitive reality is that often that doesn't happen on a campaign. It happens on every other issue that people want to talk about, but often it doesn't happen on the life issue unless somebody, and we take this on ourselves, make them do it. So I think it's getting better.
And do you find that when you sit down with candidates who tell you they're pro-life, do they usually stumble around at first in trying to articulate that or answer questions, or do you find that they're pretty well prepared?
Well, usually by the time I talk to them, they were in this past election cycle is probably the first good example, is that they know why I want to talk to them. So they even just the getting ready for that conversation is in itself very good, you know. But normally I've not seen, especially in Senate candidates or presidential candidates, that it's just terrible. Because they're already we let them know what we think are the hardest questions and we let them know we think it's important for them to go on the offense. What do you do? So they're kind of ready then. But, you know, I need help all the time. Like, I've been doing this for a lot of years and I need coaching and I need practice and I need, you know, because things change, issues change. And so it's important to refine and get it good. I mean, get it precise, succinct, and deep and satisfying. And that's the goal there. And honestly, on this, you better be that. Because to speak superficially on this or stupidly is just death.
I'm talking with Marjorie Dannenfeltzer, president of Susan B. Anthony List in Washington. And as I've said, and I'll say it again, the only truly political arm of the pro-life movement in that they get out at the grassroots and they educate voters, they knock on doors, they make phone calls, they send out mail, they make a concrete difference in the vote count at the end of the day. Marjorie, in the 2012 campaign with Governor Romney, you've told me several times how disappointed you were that the abortion issue was pretty much ignored. Do you think that had much to do with the outcome of that election?
I think that there were many factors, but I can certainly say that this is a factor, and this is why. He gave a model, in my opinion, of what not to do.
Ah.
And it was a fear-based model. It was a hope and pray that the issue doesn't come up, and if it does, you know, just blink your eye and try not to address it and move on to something else. It is nothing you would ever learn in debate. There's nothing rational about that. It is just, it's fear. It's a fear-based model. A courage-based model is one that is ready and prepared because you know who you are. You know how easy it is for all of us to avoid dealing with the things that are very difficult in life? Well, I think it's like that. I think it's very much like that, just in their own. They're human beings, too. He in particular, I think, probably just didn't really want to talk about it a lot, didn't prepare. Now, this is not an excuse. It's a reason. And he has more of an obligation to prepare than anybody in the nation. And the one strategy they had was to hope and pray that it never came up. So in one classic moment in the presidential debate, Obama said, "If you succeed in defunding Planned Parenthood, women will across the country will not get mammograms." I mean, this was just a lie that it perpetuated over and over again. Planned Parenthood doesn't provide mammograms.
They provide abortion.
No,
that's what they do.
Answer. They provide abortion, and you know sometimes they contract out, whatever. But it was certainly, especially at that time, they themselves didn't do any mammograms. I mean, definitely didn't do any mammograms. Well, he wasn't ready for that. It was the thing being most discussed on the other side, and yet he wasn't prepared or ready. He said nothing about it. There was no There was no offense, no defense. It was just a creeping into a fetal position and just praying that the bad guy would go away. That is not the model of a leader of Western civilization.
And doesn't that really limit what you were able to do and SBA List was able to do during that campaign? Doesn't that create a kind of boundary that you just can't get across?
Well, it's very, very practical. Anybody involved in business knows what the market space is for the president and what he does, and then a group of any group with any medium-sized capacity or even large to make up for a PR problem. It has to be a silent partnership. You know, you can't be communicating back and forth, but she or he doing the best possible job they can do means that they don't create huge problems for themselves. And on our side, when they do a good job, we're just the wind in their sails. We are the arms and legs of their voice, of their leadership, so that when they speak well or when they are clearly who you want them to be, our job is to spread the good word. But if there is no good word, it's really hard to spread. So what we knew to be true was that he was pro-life, believe that he's pro-life, and he was certainly better than the alternative. Fighting Obama was the approach. I mean, it was going after Obama, which is something that he was not doing. But it just did feel, you know,
You're pulling a candidate uphill, up a hill he didn't want to go.
Yeah, we just could not drag him that way, and you can't drag a kid in a direction they don't want to go. You just got to help.
So, Marjorie, I should tell our listeners that you're married, that you have mm-hmm. five children, and you've been the head of an organization that started out small, but has become very large with nearly 400,000 members and a large staff, offices in Washington, D.C., very significant factor in every election cycle. How are you able to raise kids and do all this work on behalf of life at the same time?
Well, I don't really know. I think has somehow helped this work. I mean, it has really been an extension of our family from the beginning, and I never intended to do anything outside the house. In fact, the first article written about SBA in the beginning was what I really intended to be always true. You can save the world from home. It's in World Magazine. That was the title, and it had my oldest now, the one's out of college and one's in college. It had them as little babies, you know, kind of running around. It is a constant, it's just a constant seeking for counsel and also going through seasons of life adjusting. There was many, many years where I was only at home, and then as children got older, more out of home, and then, you know, having a great team at Susan B. Anthony List in leadership and otherwise that I could trade off over time. I really believe, and I know you do too, Deal, and I've seen you do it as well, that when you're sincere in your discernment and you have your priorities in line, you won't get perfect counsel. And I can't hear perfect counsel, but I think I get it that serving everybody who I'm primarily in charge of serving gets what they need, especially if they're a part of the project of this, you know, this greatest civil rights movement of our time. I think our family feels it's a privilege to be a part of it. All of us are. And it's formed everybody in many ways.
Well, knowing your family as well as I do, I can say amen to that. I'm talking with Marjorie Dannefelter, president of the SBA List, and we've come to the end of this part of the interview and to the second half hour. Marjorie, I thank you so much for being my guest once again on Church and Culture. Will you come back soon?
It is my privilege, and I'll consider that again. Thank you, Deal.
Well, we just want to all congratulate you and everyone at Susan B. Anthony List for the fantastic work you've been doing, and I look forward to seeing the big impact you undoubtedly will have on the 2016 election.
Well, let's all do it together.
We will. And to all of our listeners, we know you'll be involved too, and please join me once again on Church and Culture this day and this hour next week.
If you have any comments or questions about Church and Culture, you can contact Deal Hudson at dhudson@avemariaradio.net.
We have a Gospel of Life talk and a dedication of a grave marker by Archbishop Vigneron as we open our new season on Putting on the Mind of Christ this week.
Perhaps the most important thing I could point out is that we are here for a profound act of religion. Yes, there are certain kinds of political implications to our action, but it is not principally for those implications that we are gathered.
UCLA staff psychiatrist Dr. Miriam Grossman exposes the agendas of Planned Parenthood and other groups as she opens our next program with a talk for parents and teens. It's Your Teaching My Child What? Then Archbishop Alan Vigneron dedicates the memorial for 23 aborted babies found in a dumpster behind an abortion mill. Listen to Putting on the Mind of Christ this Sunday afternoon at 3, encoring Saturday afternoons at 6 on 990 WDEO, 1440 WMAX, and AveMariaRadio.net on the Internet.
Hi, Deacon Tom here with a reminder that Ave Maria Radio has some terrific gift ideas for you. Books by our hosts and our guests, recordings on CD, and our new Wi-Fi radios, so you can listen to Catholic radio anywhere in the world, anytime you want, as long as you have a Wi-Fi connection. Just go to our website and click the word store on the right side of the page, just below the EWTN logo. It's an easy way to shop, and you can help Catholic radio at the same time. The website can be found at AveMariaRadio.net.
This time last year, I did a commentary on five brothers who served in World War II. Imagine my surprise when someone sent me a package with this note. Dear Professor Kengor, your commentary about the family whose five sons served in World War II was interesting. You might be interested to know about families who had more than five sons who served in World War II. Well, Mr. Ted Walters of Uniontown, Pennsylvania, had my attention. He continued, my mother, Stella Pitkovich, had seven sons serve in World War II. Yes, seven sons. Along with Ted Walters' letter was an old newspaper clipping showing six Pittsburgh-area mothers, all of Polish descent, who among them had 33 boys in service. Four of them provided five boys to the World War II cause, another offered six, and Stella took the prize with seven. Bless their souls. I don't know the fate of all 33 boys, but the Petkovich boys, remarkably, Stella's kids, mercifully all returned home. In fact, they produced a legacy of over 100 children and grandchildren. The boys were stationed all over the globe during World War II, Europe, Africa, the Middle East, Okinawa, Tokyo Bay. One of them invaded Iwo Jima. His ship bombed the Japanese mainland. Another fought in the Battle of the Bulge. It's quite a story, and the Petkovich family was fortunate enough to have everyone return home. Most families in World War II weren't so lucky. But unfortunately, this story has a sad component. Stella didn't survive the war. The mother died of cancer. She didn't live to see all her boys come home. And yet all that time she kept a stoic silence. Ted, who was 12 years old when the war ended, remembered his parents never saying anything about the war, nor his seven brothers when they returned home. No, they did their duty, they came home, they raised their families, and they served their country in other ways. As for us, how can we repay families like these for the sacrifices they made 70 years ago? Well, we can start by not destroying the America that they were willing to die for. For Ave Maria Radio, I'm Paul Kengor.